Well, hello, Valley Covenant. Thanks for having me for your talk this morning. I work for the conference office. My title is conference coach, and that's because my training is in executive coaching. And I also am working on a dissertation in psychology, studying performance psychology, as well as a concentration in organizational leadership. And prior to that, I studied at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. That's where I have my master's in divinity. And before that, I was a literature major. I focused on Shakespeare and postmodern literature. Also pre-med, didn't go through with that, but that's what I was studying. I'm also married, four kids, 24 years to Susie. This talk is about this idea of being seen. And I really understand that to be one of the primal drivers in the way that we interact with each other. I see that in marriage. I see that in friendships. I see that in society, in social media. Much of what's happening in our world today is really about this need to be seen. And of course, God is the one who sees us. And that's the first name that we as human beings have ever given to God, as the God who sees me. So I hope you enjoy this talk and I hope it's meaningful for you. And maybe one day I'll see you in person. Take care. Bye-bye. Good morning, everyone. My name is Peter and I work for the conference office. And I'm also a doctoral candidate in a psychology program. And I also work as an executive coach. And so from that perspective, I want to share a word with you that's become really meaningful and profound and just another powerful, important way for me to understand the world that I live in. And it's been especially helpful for me as I think about what all has been happening here in 2020. Up to this present day. I'm recording this on June 17th, and I'm recording this from Seattle, which has in some ways become the epicenter of the virus and also the movement that we are seeing in our society. The title of the talk is a Hebrew word, and the title is El Roy, and it means the God who sees. And so I want to talk about today the power of seeing and the importance of being seen. And we might even say the necessity of being seen. And this is a different way than I would normally talk. I'm talking into a screen. I don't have people in front of me. And so I've noticed that the trend on these video sermons has been less preachy, but more of a conversation, a little softer, a little more spacious maybe for the hearers. And so I'm going to lean into that. And I've been like a preacher's preacher for the last quarter century, but I'll try to be more conversational and a little bit softer, a little bit more spacious for you. Okay, so first, I want to start out with this idea that I've been learning about. So there's this research that shows that some of the most destructive forces that a child can experience, when you total it all up, is poverty. It really wreaks havoc, and it has a domino effect, and it's a pervasive effect on a child's life. Everything from the way the child is formed to how a child behaves and lives. And so it really impacts every aspect of a human being, poverty does. But then there's this one thing that parents can do. Parents who have a lot, parents who have a little, they can all do this. And that is what the doctors call tracking with the child's inner subjective reality, as opposed to just being reactive to their presenting external behaviors. So let me say that again. A parent, when they are able to track with the inner subjective reality of people around them, it has a profoundly powerful impact as opposed to just being reactive to their presenting behaviors, these external ways that we have We have these external ways of expressing ourselves, but it does not mean that that's what's going on the inside. A really powerful thought that somebody who is not poverty-stricken cannot be tracking with their children's inner subjective reality, and that child who knows how that impacts them. But even if you're poor, even if you're dealing with the most destructive force that we can experience or impose on families or children, if they can track with their child's inner subjective reality, it's hugely medicinal, and it mitigates and sometimes reverses the impact of poverty. And just thinking about this, just thinking about my own parents, first of all, asking the question, did they see me? Did they understand me? Did they understand what was happening to me sort of on the inside, what I was feeling, what forces I was grappling with, what realities, what I was learning, what was really hurting me, what was really helping me? Did they know this? Just asking that question has been really powerful. And then, of course, I flip the script and then I ask, well, do I see my kids? Do I see their inner subjective reality? What am I tracking? Am I judging them based on their external presentation? As I thought about this, I thought about that verse where Samuel comes looking for David so he could anoint David, except he doesn't know that it's David. And so he goes down the line through all of the sons, and he never even thinks about David, and even the father Jesse forgets about David. And then Samuel the prophet learns this incredibly valuable lesson. What does Samuel learn? That God does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance of things, but God looks at the heart. There is something that God is tracking that human beings tend not to be as good at tracking. We tend to respond to external presentations, but we have a God who tracks our inner subjective realities. How powerful is that? That even if nobody understands you, even if nobody else sees you, God sees you, and he's tracking you, and he's tracking with you. I was thinking about different ways of thinking about this. One other area that came to my mind is this idea of empathy. Empathy has been a really sort of popular idea for a long time now. But what is empathy? Empathy is this mental ability that we have to put ourselves in the shoes of somebody else. It's when what they call our mirror neurons in our brain, we pick up on what's happening to the other person, and we start imitating what we see by feeling the same thing that other people feel. And so we're able to understand. That is to say, we are able to see others, truly see what's happening, understand, and track with their inner subjective realities. Let's take another one. I really like John Gottman and his studies on marriages and relationships and what leads to successful relationships as opposed to ones that tend to fail. And if you're not familiar with the Gottman Institute, they are the ones who are able to predict the future direction of a marriage with something like a 96 to 98% accuracy. And they can do this within minutes. And the famous study that's been written about is couples would come to the center to get help for their marriage, and they would first be put into this waiting room, and they think they're waiting to see John or whoever their therapist was going to be, but they were actually being observed in the waiting room. And just by studying the way they interact with each other, they're able to predict whether that couple is basically going to make it or not with an amazing success rate. I mean, it's almost infallible if you're talking about a 98% success rate. And so what's the key? What are they looking for? Well, the basic thing that they look for is whether they respond to each other's, what he calls, bids for connection. That means that if the husband says to the wife, honey, look at this article, and maybe he's flipping through a magazine in the waiting room. And she sort of ignores him or downplays whatever he's trying to do or gets irritated at that. Then she's rejecting not his request to look at the magazine with him, but really he's trying to make an emotional connection. It's what he calls a bid for connection. And really what that is the husband saying, honey, I would love for you to see me right now. And if she refuses to see him, he registers that. And it has a cumulative effect, and over time, that leads to a break in the relationship, right? And so we have the ability to see as the key act that we can do to be connectional in relationships. And so we have Elroy, the God who sees. We have that story playing out in Samuel's search for King David. We have the word empathy. And now we have this idea presented in marriage success stories. Let's do one more. Another concept that's been really popular over the last decade or so, or 15 years, is this idea of emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is actually a technical term, and it basically breaks down into three categories. It means that you are able to track your emotional state, your mind state, and because you're tracking with what's going on inside of you internally, you're able to now regulate yourself. That's the second component of emotional intelligence. And then the third and final component of emotional intelligence is because you're able to track with yourself and therefore able to regulate, you have the resources, the bandwidth, to be able to track with how other people are doing, what they're feeling, what their inner emotional states or mind states are. So we have emotional intelligence, which is basically the ability to see yourself. And because of that, you're able to see other people. And if you're able to sort of live life and work and play and do relationships and be a family and navigate, you know, all your errands, with emotional intelligence, you're going to have a much more successful and happy life or day than if you lacked emotional intelligence. In fact, studies on emotional intelligence show that of all the different kinds of intelligences you could have, emotional intelligence is called a primary intelligence, meaning it's the first. It's the foundational intelligence that actually makes all the other intelligences useful and even intelligent. That without emotional intelligence, the other intelligences don't end up really being intelligent at all. And as they study this further, in, for example, areas like leadership or parenting, they found this to be the most critical component. Again, underscoring the same point that seeing is everything. That if you can see the inner subjective reality of a situation, of a person, of a society, then you really are ahead of the game. Now, back to the idea of Elroy. Where does Elroy come from? Well, Elroy is the Hebrew word that means the God who sees. El meaning God, Roy meaning to see, the God who sees. And it comes from Genesis chapter 16. And I don't know if you know this, but Genesis chapter 16 is the very first place in the whole Bible that God is given a name. And the fact that this name is first means that this name is primary. Before God revealed himself to us as anything else, He reveals himself to us as the God who sees. And it's amazing the story that this idea comes through. It's the story of Sarah and Abraham. Of course, in 16, Abraham is still Abram and Sarah is Sarai. And their names haven't been changed yet. And God had given a promise to Abram that he would be the father of many children. And then it wasn't happening. And so Sarah decides that maybe the way God wanted them to have many children was not through her, body, but through the wife of the slave woman named Hagar. And so Sarah suggests to Abraham that he go into her and have children by her instead, by Hagar instead of by her. And so Abraham does that, and then Hagar becomes pregnant with Abraham's child, and we know that she gives birth and she names him Ishmael. Just a little side note, this is a different sermon, but worth noting here that I think Ishmael represents man's attempt to bless himself, and Isaac is God's promise. And this is just another powerful truth, because so many times I think I and we try to bless ourselves, we try to make good things happen, and we force things, we rush things, we exploit people, we cheat the system, we do these ambitious, aggressive, speedy things to try to fulfill some sense of promise that we feel we're entitled to or we feel we need. But aside from that stands God's promise, his promise of provision, of love, and starting with Genesis 16, of seeing us. So that's another sermon, but there it is. And so basically the story goes like this. Hagar is a slave. She is raped by Abraham, I presume multiple times. And I'm putting things sort of truthfully, but harshly and starkly on purpose, because I want you to get the point here, that she was raped by Abraham, and she was already a slave to begin with. And then she is abused so severely that with child, she runs away into the wilderness to, in effect, commit a double suicide. And so she is there in the wilderness, in the desert, waiting to die. She is totally vulnerable. She is what you would call, what we would call today, an invisible person, totally disenfranchised. She is not even considered human. She is property. She is an object. Her life has no value. There's very little consequence to anything that might happen to her. She has no rights. She has no hope. She has no lifeline. She has no recourse. She is invisible and vulnerable and waiting to die. And it is in this context that God first reveals himself. And what does she feel? What does she do? Her response to this God who sees, is recorded for us in Genesis chapter 16, verse 13. It says this, 13 says, she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. You are the God who sees me. For she said, I have now seen the one who sees me. So God always has been the one who sees us. But here, God reveals himself as the one who sees us. And this revelation leads to her naming God El Roy, the God who sees. So there are so many verses like this. If you wanted to do a systematic study of this idea, there's seemingly no end to this idea that God sees. You know, for example, we have 2 Chronicles, for the eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. We have a myriad of verses where God talks about how he watches over us, how he doesn't sleep, and how he's always with us. The eyes of the Lord are everywhere, Proverbs 15 tells us. And we have Matthew. Jesus tells us, remember that your Father sees the hidden good you do and will reward you. That's Matthew 6 in the Sermon on the Mount. And then we have Paul talking to the Corinthian church. He says, I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what I think about me. I only care what God thinks about me. It's for his eyes that I do what I do. And it's his judgment that matters to me. And Paul declares his freedom from people and his submission to God, his concern for God and what God sees, because he is El Roy, the God who sees. So there you have it. That's the idea. And I think it's really powerfully and substantially supported in multiple disciplines, secular or theological. I don't think we can escape this idea that seeing really is foundational. It's primary, it's crucial, it's medicinal, it mitigates, it reverses circumstances. It's the cornerstone of redemption and how redemption happens. And so I wanted to end this talk by talking about what's happening in our society. You know, putting aside the coronavirus for a moment here, talking about the Black Lives Matter movement that's caught fire all across our country and really the world. I was just reading today about the protests that are happening in China in support of America. And what is it? What is happening? Why the phenomenon? And I think a really important aspect of this, and maybe it is the most important aspect, is that historically speaking, African Americans, Black Americans, have received the message from white America over and over and over again that we do not see you. We do not track with your inner subjective reality. When a Black man says, "I can't breathe," we don't hear it. When a somebody that is not white is speaking the same language, there is almost a seeming inability to perceive what is happening. And that has been the experience. And we could even say it's been the subjective experience. We don't even have to go to the point of arguing that it's an objective reality. We can say, even if it's subjective, we, America has not been tracking with this. And so there is a cry to be seen, a cry to be seen as human, a cry to be seen as somebody, a people group that matters. And so America here stands at this point. And the question that I have for not just white America, but for all of us is, will we see? Will we open our eyes and really choose to see, ask to see what's really happening? I think there's a lot to learn if we want to see. I've been trying to see this. I've been trying to understand this. And my own study into this topic has led me to the year 1619. And this is my personal view, which I will share here, is that until we are willing to go back as far back as 1619, and that's the year that the first slaves were purchased, almost accidentally, near Jamestown. And then the slave trade started. Until we are willing to go back to that year, I'm not sure we're going to have the necessary conversation that we need to have to be able to move forward. And then if you want to go even further to the treatment and the plight of Native Americans in this country, you know, you begin to wonder, was this country really founded on Christian principles? Was it really founded on the more rosy story that we've been told? I don't think the 1619 narrative necessarily precludes the God and the sort of the spiritual angle to the birth of our country. I think that given where our consciousness was at that time as a world, I think that those two narratives sort of stand together. But having said that, I personally think it's really important to see, to look into how we got here, what all has happened. And there's no dearth of information and just access to all the bodies of truth out there if you really want to do the work to see. And that's my invitation to you, to join God in how he does what he does, which is by seeing, by understanding, by tracking with the inner subjective reality of things. Elroy, the God who sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance of things, but God looks at the heart. Amen.